Hey, folks, you're listening to the Ring of Fire Radio free podcast. You're catching a little bit of discussion of the week's news and an interview. Well, there's a whole lot more of that where that came from. Every week, we have at least an hour's worth of discussion of some of the top stories of the week. And then we have anywhere from three to four more interviews that you can listen to from reporters who have done a deep dive into a specific issue or topic. So check out our member show. That's at rofpodcast.com. It's just a couple of dollars a week, and you get the full show. And you also provide the revenue for this show to stay on the air. Keeps us on terrestrial radio, and it pays for us to do this show week in, week out. That's rofpodcast.com. Check out what you're missing. Support this endeavor. Support the media you enjoy. All right, folks, have a good week. Enjoy the rest of the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, we'll explain why states that have right to carry gun laws also have a higher rate of violent crime with the nation's Mike Konzel. Alicia Sperry from The Intercept will join us to discuss the rampant rate of sexual abuse among women held in immigration detention centers across the country. Eric Blanc from Jacobin Magazine will get us up to date on recent teacher strikes happening in red states, including Arizona. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down this week's biggest news stories. And Evan Hughes will join us to discuss an incredible piece in the New York Times detailing a kickback scheme involving millions of dollars between an opioid manufacturer and doctors. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, let's start with the White House Correspondents' Dinner that took place last week. Last weekend, I guess. And this is an annual event. At different times, it has more prominence than other times. It's something that I've always found to be somewhat problematic, frankly, on some level, because it, I don't know, I guess some reporters say there's value in talking to all these administration officials in a different context. That's all well and good. At different times, it's become more of a red carpet affair, which I find I'm not terribly interested in. But Michelle Wolf, she is a writer for The Daily Show. She has her own show on Netflix. Had a did her monologue, and it was pretty scathing. I think some of it was pretty funny, some of it was okay. But what was sort of most interesting about it was the reaction from the press.
That was what was interesting about it. I mean, I thought I personally found her set pretty funny and kind of and sharp in a way that I thought was maybe a little bit even more intelligent than I normally expect from that particular event. Especially if I really recommend, if people haven't seen it, or even if they have seen it, to go and read the jokes in written form. I think the Washington Post did a transcript of it, and they're very, very sharp and very interesting and really right on the money. So, I mean, I was impressed with her. But, that's me, of course. I hate Trump and hate the administration, so that's fine and dandy. We all sort of break down into our little tribes on this. But it's what you said that is really astonishing about this particular event and the flap. It's the way the press reacted. And the way the press reacted, first of all, I agree with you. I think this whole event should be canceled. I have thought so, though, for, 15 years.
Right.
Because the idea of the press coming together in this, and this is nonsense, the idea that we just think it's a good idea for us to behave like human beings for one night with each other and, kid each other and blah, blah, blah. That is just garbage, because the truth is that this is a sucking up to power if there ever was. They all get in there, they pretend like they're going to the Oscars, and in the process of doing that, they share their mutual celebrity. They celebrate it. That's what that's all about. And it absolutely, at this point, degrades the press in and of itself by doing that. And we have enough of that. I mean, if you don't know the danger of that stuff, from watching what's happened with having a reality TV star tabloid, New York con man as a president, they should. And the idea that in this particular one that they got up on their high horse and, oh, it was so terrible, and, Sarah Huckabee Sanders deserves an apology, and et cetera, et cetera. This administration has declared war on them.
They did that after
everything. Trump simultaneously, as the thing was going on, was in Michigan degrading them as disgusting human beings, and his followers were standing in front of the cage that they put the media in at his rallies, screaming at them and spitting on them and calling them, every name in the book, calling them filth. And these people were sitting there in that audience and going, oh, I'm so offended on Sarah Huckabee Sanders' behalf, the woman who works and apologizes for this man every day. It was disgusting. And I'm sorry, the press, I'm trying so hard to, keep myself from going on a crusade against the media. They're doing important work. There are many great investigative reporters. There's a lot of important reporting that's coming out right now, in adversarial reporting against the Trump administration. So I appreciate that. But it's this kind of thing that makes people on both sides absolutely look at the media and go, what is the point? Why am I defending you? What are you doing? And so that this whole thing, I really thought, was a very telling moment, and I'm kind of hopeful. I know that we don't want Donald Trump to get any wins, but if we give him one win, let's give him the win of canceling the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Right.
I'll give him credit for that one, if that's what we need to do.
Let me just dwell on the White House Correspondents' Dinner, more generally. Back in the aughts, it was given, on the advent of Twitter, it was given the nickname Nerd Prom. And I know in your piece in Salon, you cited that as well. And I think we should just sort of it gives an interesting insight into the way that the reporters see themselves and the way that the journalists see themselves. Right. Because if it was the Jock Prom, they would, because look, there's no nerds when you're adults, right? This is a term from high school. There's a certain amount of aggrievement when you self-identify this way. And of course, they're doing it ironically, right? Because they don't really think they're nerds. There's a certain amount of aggrievement. And so these are people who are put upon and almost make it feel like we deserve it. We deserve this prom. And that is what is at the heart sort of problematic about it. And it's that same sort of righteousness that I think they are out there so vociferously defending Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I think on one level, it's that notion that we're a priesthood and we need to protect it. On the other hand, I think there's also a lot of them who are doing it just for access, and they're selling out that fundamental premise. And look, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about what the implications of a press that is so easily able to sort of decontextualize everything and sort of revert to form. And it's particularly relevant because of what we saw this week from Bibi Netanyahu. And what we're seeing from the administration, more broadly speaking, which seems to be an attempt to line some ducks up in a row, at the very least, to assault the Iran nuclear deal, and could be, in fact, an attempt to sell another war. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Digby in just a moment. Counting all different ideas drifting away. Past and present, that don't matter, not the future, sort it out. Watch your moving in the elliptical, but I think it's not what you say. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, when we broke, we were talking about Michelle Wolf and the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and particularly about the dinner more generally, but particularly the press's knee-jerk reaction to, I guess, admonishing Michelle Wolf for supposedly her sexist attack on Sarah Huckabee Sanders, which is, I think that was both groundless and ridiculous, right? Like, I don't think that was even a legitimate criticism for anybody to make, more broadly speaking, and it's even more ridiculous for the media to do that, to make those criticisms in that context. But it is indicative of a media that in some respects has not reformed, that still is too, I guess, prostrate to power in this country. And it is problematic because, you know, and if you have any more to say about the Correspondents' Dinner, by all means. But one of the other things that took place this week in terms of media circuses was Bibi Netanyahu's quasi-TED Talk, supposedly about the Israelis collecting new information about the Iranian nuclear weapons program, which does not exist, and even as delivered by Bibi Netanyahu, exists only in the context of documents that were written, that were already reported on from prior to 2003. I mean, just give me your take on the response to that endeavor and where you put that in the greater sort of context in which the Trump administration seems to be moving to quash the Iran nuke deal.
Well, as far as the media is concerned and the way that they looked at it, I mean, I don't think any of us who have been around a while could escape the echoes of a previous presentation that was made to the world by Colin Powell back in the early, in 2002, when he presented to the world all the evidence of Saddam's alleged weapons of mass destruction program, all of which turned out to be bunk, right? So you see this, you see Netanyahu come out and giving Powell at least credit for putting together a better presentation. I mean, at least it actually appeared to be credible. This one, right there on the screen on his PowerPoint, it was obvious that what he was saying was old news, but it was more the pageantry of it, right? And the media stopped everything. Oh my God, he's making a big comment. And then we're waiting word from the Trump administration. I literally at the time tweeted, oh my God, is it war? I mean, that was the approach that the media took to this particular thing.
the sense of anticipation is what you're saying. It was so great that it was going to be something monumental. Right.
Right. I mean, that's certainly how I initially took it until I actually watched the thing and then realized, you know, geez, this is nothing. But it doesn't really matter because the whole point is, again, it's another of these sort of kabuki dances, right, where everybody kind of knows that this is old news. Everybody knows that John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are chomping at the bit to go into Iran or to at least tear up the deal and then somehow find a pretext for some kind of confrontation, God help us. I don't know what it is. There's word of, you know, troops rushing to the border in Israel, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know where that's going. But this whole idea, you can feel this buildup, right? And there's a little sense, an undercurrent of excitement. And, of course, with Trump, there's all this other stuff going on with the, you know, with the Mueller investigation and Stormy Daniels and his doctor and a million other things, right? But this one, do you feel it? I mean, can you feel the sense of excitement growing in the media? Because I can,
definitely.
And it's very, very reminiscent of other times that we've been through this. We did it in the first Gulf War, and it happened in the second, in the Iraq War. And it's very concerning, very, very, very concerning, because as you put it, there is a problem with the media being able to contextualize these kinds of things. They just seem to be, it's entirely predictable how they're going to react. I mean, with Trump, the scandal, you know, scandal-plagued president with Stormy and all the other stuff, that's one part of them. They also like that, you know. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. That's a big part of, and that's one excitement, you know, excited narrative that they have. But the biggie, the big excited narrative that really gets them going is war. And, I am very, very concerned watching all this kind of unfold and seeing how Pompeo, Bolton, Netanyahu, even the typo, you know, I don't know if everybody knows, but after he gave his big speech, the Trump administration released an official statement saying that Iran has a nuclear program. And it was hours later that they went back and fixed it, saying had a nuclear program.
Yes, that's a pretty big that letter. Those two letters are pretty substantial in terms of their implications.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, I don't know how to interpret that. It could be that Trump and his people actually believed Netanyahu. They watched it and went, oh my God, you know, Iran has a nuclear program, you know, this is terrible, we've got to do something. Maybe they really believed that, or maybe this was all some kind of propaganda that they'd had all cooked up ahead of time. I mean, it's very hard to know. The fact that a typo, I don't think so. There was some consciousness there of one kind or another, and this whole thing happened, you know,
it's just as scary if it's a typo.
It was a good thing.
It's just as scary if it's a typo too, right? I mean, like they're so untethered. Yes, incompetent and untethered to the facts. And you know, we just have a minute left, but I sense that same excitement from the press, and I definitely do not think that the groundwork has been laid in the way that it was in Iraq, and perhaps because of the Iraq War, it's much harder to do so. And the idea of invading Iran. I think we have a depleted military, et cetera, et cetera. There clearly is not the same, the American public, the American intelligentsia, the military, none of the same elements are on board.
And no,
however,
9/11, which is a big
and 9/11, yes. But my fear is that it doesn't matter. That if there's ever been an administration that doesn't need in its own mind to have the American public on board, it would be this one. But Digby, we got to take a break. We'll come back in the next hour if you'll join me. We got a lot of stuff to talk about in terms of the president, his doctor, Robert Mueller, all that and more when we return. My name is Sam Sear. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Coming up, Mike Konzel explains why more guns actually means more violent crime. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. The NRA and many Republican lawmakers love to tout the solution that more guns is the answer to gun violence and mass shootings. But a recent study has put an end to that ridiculous notion, and here to explain why more guns actually means more violent crime, Mike Konzel from The Nation magazine. So, Mike, this week, Donald Trump meeting with the NRA, one of the I don't know that there was much that was unexpected, but one of the highlights being that the Secret Service somehow has not gotten the memo that folks are more safe with the more guns that are in any given context, and therefore did not allow the NRA members to bring in their weapons to the presentation by the president. Now, of course, this breaks the cardinal rule of you can't possibly. This made the area a soft target, as it were, on some level, without everyone being armed to the teeth. And so your piece that actually guns do kill people is apropos. Maybe the NRA got wind of the research that you talked about. But tell us a little bit about past studies. Like, where were we on this in terms of data, let's say in pre-2000?
Yeah, I mean, if a good guy with a gun saves lives, a stadium full of good men with guns is no doubt like the safest place in the world. So
it could raise people from the dead, perhaps.
So the short answer is we didn't have a ton of great data one way or the other in the late 90s. This is right when a lot of conservative arguments. People with better knowledge can time this better, but it's probably right when the NRA becomes a lot more militarized and a lot more conservative. It's also a period of a lot of like militias. If you go back then, a lot of like the beginnings of this kind of bubbling, you know, real localized right wing insurgency stuff. And there was a study by a guy named Lott. Said it was summarized in a bigger paper called "More Guns, Less Crime." And the idea there was, and it was a little shaky at the time, and people ran different models that found different things, but they argued that if you pass a right to carry law, a right that's basically, you know, you force states shall issue concealed carry permits to its citizens. They don't have any kind of discretion in how to set it up broadly. Then crime would go down, violent crime would go down. And this is during a period in which violent crime and all crimes are going down everywhere. We can talk a little bit about why that was. Yeah. And so it looked like it was there. But now out here in 2018, those results don't look so good.
All right. Well, let's talk about that era. You're right. George Herbert Walker Bush, in fact, I remember, quit the NRA. I think it was in 1995. It was shortly after Wayne LaPierre, I think, became a more vocal presence in the NRA. He became vice president. He had some rather radical things to say in the wake after the 1995 bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. And this is also, like you say, almost in the wake of the broad-based decline in crime across the country in most places. Give us your assessment as to why we saw that drop in crime. Was it because more people were carrying guns?
No, we actually find that that's not the case. And so I'll talk about this. Yeah, so why did crime go down? People actually don't know very well. The important thing to note is that all kinds of crimes go down. So it's not necessarily like there's better awareness about rape or better awareness about drunk driving. And it also goes down everywhere. So it's hard to say like New York had the secret sauce to bring down crime, because crime also went down like Kansas City and Chicago. So, you know, a lot of the kind of specific issues no doubt play roles, but aren't the main cause. The thing that links up very well is reduction in lead in the environment.
Yes. This is my favorite theory of unintended consequences of government regulation.
It's super crazy, and it also shows up internationally well.
Yes.
You know, like states that got lead out of their gasoline and started pulling it out of their environment earlier showed a downtick in violent crime. And we know lead has really negative effects on all kinds of behavioral, you know, things with young children. So it's sort of crazy, you know, everyone's talking about it. We flooded guns in all these places, and we threw so many millions of people in jail, and we did all this reactionary stuff. But then it also is just like good regular environmental causes actually stopped all the crime.
And here's the thing, is that we have seen this is not a one-time event. I mean, people have been waiting for crime to rebound, maybe as a function of the economy, maybe as a function of ending policies like stop and frisk, maybe in, you know, as a function of people attempting at certain points to respect the rights of different citizens. And the crime stays down. It seems to be invincible. The decline in the crime rate seems to be invincible when it comes to any policy changes or any other changes. And the only thing that has remained the same is obviously there is less lead in our environment. But of course, if you are just looking at a fairly narrow data set from the 90s, it's possible you could conclude that because in some areas we allowed more guns, that this was the cause. Yet we also have now a new data set, and that's a function of more states, unfortunately, in my opinion, increasing the ability of its citizens to conceal and carry.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people thought maybe it's just that a function of being there a lot of young people, that there's a lot of crime, people in like late teenage, early 20s, but like we had the millennials come and go, no crime wave, unemployment. We had 10% unemployment, the Great Recession, huge dislocation with the foreclosure crisis, no crime wave. So yeah, it's definitely stayed down. And it's also masked a relative increase for the states that increased their amount of concealed carry. So, you know, people say there's, you know, three kinds of lies, darn lies, and statistics. And I don't want to come here and say, well, a statistic proved that it happened. What really jumped, and I was genuinely agnostic. I'm not a big anti-gun person. I was raised by cops. I grew up around guns. But I was genuinely agnostic, kind of skeptical, because I've heard a lot of stories about, you know, a bar fight that goes, instead of a black eye, two people shoot each other and die because they both had concealed carries. But I always wondered how much that was around to really impact it, if you could actually have enough of those stories that impact it. And I think the evidence is really conclusive in this direction. One is the first and most obvious thing, though it's the smallest thing, is that a lot of those initial studies, when you run it again and you have 20 plus states that pass it from the 90s into the mid-aughts and now decades of data, those initial studies show a large increase in violent crimes, 10 to 15% higher, statistically significant. We're talking violent crimes. We're talking robbery, rape, aggravated assault, murder, manslaughter, very serious crimes. And the people who made those studies have largely backed away, in part because they've won, so they just kind of count their victories now. But they also aren't trying to fight the empirics anymore. On the study that I write about for The Nation magazine, they do four different ways. Go ahead.
Hold on for one second. Can you just clarify? So there were studies that showed as concealed carry became more prominent, there was an increase in violent crime.
Yeah, absolutely. So the original study that showed that in around 1995 to 1997 is when the study was kind of put out and pushed. They said the few states in the early 90s that increased concealed carry, that passed concealed carry laws, saw a decline in violent crime. If you did their same statistics, their same approach, but added in the extra 25 years and added or extra 20 years and added in the extra 20 states, you would see that violent crime actually does increase, and it gets bigger years down the road.
All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about, you were about to introduce four elements to this study. Let's take a break. And when we do that, we will come back. I am Sam Cedar talking to Mike Konzel about his piece in The Nation, Actually, Guns Do Kill People. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Mike Konzel from The Nation magazine about his piece, Actually, Guns Do Kill People. So, Mike, in the last segment, you were walking us through the history of, and it's a rather sparse history, and has picked up as more of our country has become taken over by right-wingers, and we have seen an increase in the number of states that now allow for concealed carry. But you were walking us through some of the data that showed up in the 90s in terms of the implications of legalizing concealed carry. And when we broke, you had just told us that if you looked at the methodology of measuring concealed carry on violent crime in the 90s, it appears as if violent crime is going down. But if you then add all the data that we now have 20 some odd years later, with a lot more states that have allowed concealed carry, and you use that exact same methodology, you ask the same questions in the same way, it looks like violent crime has gone up. You said there were four elements to this study. Tell us what those elements were.
Sure. So that's one, is kind of the original conservative approach to controlling for state effects. There's three others, and they are basically the kind of three to four ways you would handle these kinds of studies. I think the important thing for the audience, rather than getting into dry statistics stuff, and you can check out the paper it's linked to in my Nation column about it, is that all four of them point in the same exact direction. They're all significant, and they're all about the same range, 10 to 15% increase in violent crimes. My background's, I'm an economist, and I don't do a lot of this kind of public policy around guns, but to me, that's crazy on point. You don't see that very often. For instance, the same kinds of things with looking at states that do minimum wage, one or two of them will show a slight increase in unemployment, and the other two will show no effect. And then you have to get into it and argue, okay, well, the ones that show no effect are actually probably better. They control for things better. They're more analytically sound. Here, we don't even have to have that conversation because all of the major methods all point in the same direction and all give plausibly the same results. That's very surprising. And when I say that this is becoming a consensus, a lot of people looking at this are increasingly agreeing that there is something here.
Because basically you're saying that, you know, when you do studies, you invariably will have mixed messages from the data, and you need to tease this out. And in this instance, no matter how you slice it, the message is the same. You have concealed carry, you're going to have more violent crime.
Exactly. And it's a pretty big effect. 10 to 15% is a lot higher. You would, they argue, and you can debate this, like, in order to kind of bring that down, you would essentially, given some estimates of the relationship between incarceration and crime, you'd have to, like, double the prison population. It's a major increase in crime. Again, it's masked by declining crime rates during this period, but they would be even lower in states if they had not passed these.
Right. And so how do you measure for that? I mean, if the crime rate has been either falling or plateauing, how do you measure that there has been an increase in crime that is attributable to concealed carry? Is it just simply that they go in and they say, how many of these crimes have been committed with someone who is a legal concealed carry gun owner?
So they don't do it that way because that's not necessarily the most obvious channel. Now, they kind of point to three or four big channels. One is the kind of road rage phenomena, right, which is, you know, and I talk about an example, a really tragic example in Michigan where two people, one was tailgating the other, and they pulled in the parking lot to yell at each other. But instead of, you know, just screaming or maybe punching each other, they both men had concealed carry licenses and pulled them out and shot each other and died in the hospital later. That would not have happened a generation ago. But the idea of people carrying guns into volatile situations that become far worse, or, you know, kind of having this vigilante mindset where they're carrying a gun on a bus and they're freaked out that someone's like reaches into their purse for a gun, but it's also a gun, like those kinds of situations. That's definitely one avenue. Another avenue is that people who want to commit crimes can carry guns, and they can also find guns easier. You know, someone was telling me after I wrote this about, in some places, if you have an NRA sticker on your car, criminals will break into your car more often thinking that they might find a gun, which is like finding a jackpot for them. And so there's that channel. And there's also a channel where it's harder to do police work. If you're going into a situation in which you don't know if the person has a gun, is the person you're there to respond to or responding to it, or, you know, this kind of vigilantiness really does reduce the effectiveness of law enforcement generally. So there's a lot of ways to get there outside the idea that it's specifically people with the guns causing crimes. So even a small shift there can have really big down effects, effects downstream.
So how widely, you say that there's a lot of folks who are looking at this data and they're, there's not a lot of people who walk away going like, well, it's a little bit ambiguous. But how widely is this data permeating across the ideological spectrum?
I actually first heard of this when, you know, obviously after some of the tragic shootings in the past year, I was reading a couple conservative-ish, not like gun nut people, but people who are not sympathetic to gun control on the whole, public policy professors or people in that world who deal with policy. And I was like asking them, or, you know, just kind of informally asking them what they thought worked. And a thing I heard all the time was, don't extend concealed carry, because that's obvious. Even though I, this public policy person, does not think, you know, assault rifle ban or all this other stuff shows much promise, concealed carry clearly is an issue. So that actually got me interested in the data, which in the result was this Nation piece, because I was like, okay, wow. So because that did not occur to me that that would be a frontline thing, is just to not do something bad. You know, we're thinking about how to pull back, but just not extending the bad stuff we're already doing is a good idea.
And that is really in play right now, this notion of extending concealed carry, right? Because you say, what do we have it in, 33 states now? But they're not the most populous of states, obviously. And Congress, and this is like a zombie bill, and it's come up multiple times, but every time it does, there is another major mass shooting, which makes it more awkward for Congress to pass this bill. But tell us about this reciprocity bill and what it would do.
Yeah, it's crazy. Basically, it would make it so that if you were licensed in a state to carry a concealed weapon, you would have to, every other state would have to respect it. So basically, it would mean that concealed carry people could carry their guns anywhere, which would kind of nullify state law in practice or make it not work at all. And what's interesting, and this has been brought up to me, is that certain arguments about the way the bill could go, and if it does pass, is that you could have this kind of race to the bottom effect where everyone gets registered in New Hampshire because there is literally zero requirements. You kind of just sign up online. And so even states that do have concealed carry but try to have some sort of responsibility around it might not even be able to keep that, which is pretty remarkable. In the same way, all your credit card offers are from like Wyoming or Colorado, or every corporation is from Delaware, you might have a citizenry that's licensed in the way New Hampshire, which is not an urban environment and not in, you know, essentially a rural state, wants to license its people.
So if I understand you correctly, there's concern that this may supersede, even if you have a concealed carry in state, I don't know, like let's just call it North Carolina, but you're not allowed to bring your gun into a bar, or you're not allowed to bring it. I'm just hypothetically, I don't know, not allowed to bring it into a football game. If New Hampshire says it's okay, you just go on there, you sign up, and then you can take your gun anywhere.
Yeah, that's the kind of scenarios we have to be worried about with this. Or if, you know, a state wants to pass a thing that says people with a history of domestic abuse can't conceal carry or even own a gun, you know, New Hampshire might be able to supersede the concealed carry part. So there's genuine worry about it. There's a reason why cops a organization representing 18,000 police districts have asked for the Senate not to pass this. And, you know, cops are by and large Trump people, they're Second Amendment people, but they're not for this, which is very telling.
Let me join them in asking the Senate not to pass this. Mike Konzel, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Mike Konzel is a contributor to The Nation magazine and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on financial reform, inequality, and a progressive vision of the economy. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Make sure you check out ROFpodcast.com to get the whole show.